I missed. I leaned closer to him, taking in the scent of aqua velva. When he repeated himself, his voice in my ear set up a tickling chill that went down to my feet. "Let's get out of here," he said. He got up and grabbed his raincoat off the seat across from him. I nodded and began to inch my way toward the door again. I could feel him following, one hand against my back. The gesture assumed a familiarity I should have objected to, but didn't. We paused at the entrance while I collected my slicker and my umbrella. He shrugged into his raincoat and turned the collar up. "Where to?" he asked. "There's a place, one block over. Emile's at the beach. We can walk." His umbrella was the larger, so he raised it and held it over my head as we emerged into the pelting rain. I kept my hand on the stem a fraction of an inch from his, and we moved forward with the odd gait one assumes when walking in tandem. The rain was coming down so hard the water was propelled through the umbrella fabric like a mist. A car passed, throwing up a plume that landed in front of us with a splat. Tommy stopped. "Oh, this is nuts. I've got a car right here." He took his keys out and unlocked the passenger side door on a new Porsche, painted candy apple red, with a license plate that read, "Hevner 2. I stepped from the curb to the interior. Not a dainty maneuver given the low-slung chassis and the torrents of rainwater coursing through the gutter. He closed me in on my side and then circled in front of the car to his. The interior was done in caramel-colored leather, the whole of it smelling as earthy and rich as a tack room. "Where's your pickup?" I said. "That's business. This is play. You look great. I've missed you." We chatted about nothing in particular on the short drive over to Emile's. Tommy left me off at the door. I went inside and staked out a claim for us while he found a place to park. We were seated at a table for two, next to the window in the narrow side room. The air smelled of sautéed garlic and onion, roasting chicken, and marinara sauce. The atmosphere was intimate, with only half the tables occupied because of the rain. There was a quiet buzz of conversation and the occasional clatter of silverware. Votive candles provided circles of light in the darkened space. The waiter brought us two menus, and after a quick consultation, Tommy ordered a bottle of California Chardonnay. While we waited for that, he sat and played with a fork, making plow lines along the edges of a paper napkin. His watch was white gold, and he wore a gold ID bracelet, heavy links glimmering against his ruddy skin. "I went back and read your rental application. You're divorced." I held up two fingers. He said, "I've never been married. Too much of a rolling stone." "I tend to appeal to guys on the move," I said. "Maybe I'll surprise you. Where's your family?" "My parents died in a car accident when I was 5 years old. I was raised by my mother's sister, my Aunt Jin. She's dead now, too." "No siblings?" I shook my head. "What about the husbands? Who were they?" "The first was a cop. I met him when I was a rookie."
"You were a cop?"
"For 2 years."
"And the second?"
"He was a musician. Very talented. Not so good at being faithful, but he was nice in other ways. He cooked and played piano.
Skills I admire.
And where is he now?"
"I haven't any idea."
"You said your parents were gone?"
"Oh, it's weird being an adult orphan, though not as bad as you'd think."
"What'd your father do for a living?"
"Mail carrier.
My folks were married 15 years before I came along."
"So you only had 5 years together as a family."
"I guess that's right. I hadn't thought of it that way."
"Poor babe.
Poor everyone. Such is life," I said. The waiter returned with our Chardonnay, and we watched him politely as he went through the ritual of extracting the cork, presenting a sample of wine, and then pouring two glasses. We hadn't even looked at the menu, so we were accorded a few minutes to decide what we wanted. I ended up ordering the roast chicken, and Tommy ordered the pasta puttanesca. We shared a salad up front. Once the entrees arrived, Tommy said,
"Tell me about the boyfriend. What's the deal on him?"
I lowered my fork, feeling defensive on Dietz's behalf.
Why should I talk to you about him? Don't be so prickly. I'd like to know what's going on here. Between us. Nothing's going on. We're having dinner. Oh, I think there's more to it than that. Really? As in what? I have no idea. That's why I'm asking you. What are we doing here? Defining our relationship? I've known you an hour. His smile was slow. He seemed unaffected by my churlishness, which I couldn't seem to control. Actually, I think it's closer to 2 hours than one. I saw you at the rental property twice before, and now this. He finished the wine in his glass and poured himself more, adding wine to my glass first. His eyes were really the most extraordinary shade of green. I said, "Well, I haven't known you long enough. Besides, you're too young." He lifted his brows, and I found myself blushing. I said, "How did you decide to move to Santa Teresa?" "You're changing the subject." "I don't like to be pushed," I said. "Let's talk about sex. Tell me what you like in bed, in case it ever comes up." I laughed. "Let's talk about grade school. I hated mine. How'd you feel about yours?" "Good. It was fun. I was captain of the safety council 2 years in a row. I went to 4 different colleges, but didn't graduate. I may try it again someday. I'd like to finish my degree." "I did 2 semesters of junior college and didn't like it at all. I took Spanish in adult education, but I've forgotten everything except hola and buenos dias." "You cook?" "No, but I'm a tidy little thing." "Me too. My brother's a pig. You'd never guess it by looking. He dresses okay, but his car's a mess." "I carry cans of motor oil in my back seat." "Part of your work," he said forgivingly. We chattered on in this fashion, and I found myself liking his face. Also, I was not exactly unaware of his body, lean and muscular. I wondered where Dietz was tonight. Not anywhere in range, so what difference did it make? Few men appeal to me, not so much because I'm picky about them. I'm protective of myself, which means I disqualify all but the most... what? I couldn't think what it was that allowed some men to get through my defenses. Chemistry, I guess. I focused on cutting my chicken, trying a sample of mashed potatoes, which rank right up there with peanut butter, in my opinion. Tommy touched my hand. "Where'd you disappear to?" I looked up to find him staring at me. I moved my fingers away from his. "Is this a date?" "Yes." "Because I don't date." "I can tell." "I'm serious," I said. "I'm not good at this boy-girl stuff." "You must be. You were married twice, and now you have this other boyfriend on the string." "I've had guys in between. That doesn't mean I handle it well." "You do fine. I like you. You don't have to be a jerk. Lighten up." Humbled, I said, "Okay." When we left the restaurant at 9 o'clock, the streets were still glistening with the rain which had passed. I saw his Porsche parked across the street. The children's playground was dark, and the boats in the marina beyond were bobbing dots of light. I waited while he unlocked the car and let me in. Once he fired up the engine, he said, "Something I want to show you. It's early yet, okay?" He pulled away from the curb and did a U-turn on Cabana Boulevard. We drove west, passing the Yacht Harbor on our left and Santa Teresa City College on our right. Up the hill on Seashore, left at the next big intersection. Without being told, I knew we were on our way to Horton Ravine. He smiled over at me. "I want to show you the house." "What about Richard? Won't he object?" "He drove down to Bell Garden to play poker tonight." "What if he loses and comes home?" "He won't come back until morning, whatever happens." We drove through the stone pillars that marked the rear entrance to Horton Ravine. The road was wide and dark. Many properties on either side were unfenced and had the look of rural countryside, pastures and stables, house lights twinkling through the trees. The route he took was circuitous, and I suspected his intention was to demonstrate the power and handling of the Porsche. At length, he turned right and up a short driveway to a Half Moon motor court. I caught a sweeping glimpse of the house. Stucco walls, massive lines, red tile roof. All the arches and balconies were washed with dramatic exterior lights. He reached for the remote garage door opener, pressed a button, and then swung into the open bay of a four-car garage. The cavernous space was pristine, new white drywall that smelled of the plaster overcoating. Three spaces were empty. I imagined Richard driving a sports car as new and flashy as Tommy's. I opened the car door on my side and let myself out while Tommy got out and fished for his house key. There were no shelves, no tools, and no junk piled up. No lawn chairs, no cardboard boxes marked Xmas, etc. He led us into the utility area off the kitchen. The indicator on the alarm panel by the door was dark. There was a half bath and maid's quarters to the left, a laundry room on the right. There were stacks of junk mail on the kitchen counters, catalogs and flyers. In a separate pile, there were instruction manuals for the answering machine, the microwave oven, and the Cuisinart, which had clearly never been used. The floors were done in dull red Mexican pavers, sealed and polished to a high gloss. Tommy tossed his keys on the glossy white tile counter. "So, what do you think?" "No alarm system? That seems odd in a house this size." "Spoken like a cop. There's actually one installed, but it isn't hooked up. When we first moved in, Richard set it off so often, the company started charging us $50 a pop, and the cops refused to show. We figured, what's the point? Oh, let's hope the burglars haven't heard." "We're insured. Come on, I'll give you the 10-cent tour." He walked me through the house, pausing to fill me in on their decorating plans. On the first level, wide plank oak floor stretched through the living room, dining room, family room, paneled den, and two guest rooms. The upstairs was fully carpeted in cream-colored wool. Two master suites, a workout room, and enough closet space for 10. The place had the feel of a model home in a brand new subdivision, minus all the furniture and foo-foo. Many rooms were empty, and those that had furniture seemed empty nonetheless. I realized Tommy traveled light, like me. No kids, no pets, and no houseplants. In the family room, there was a fully stocked wet bar, too much black leather, and a big-screen television for sporting events. I didn't see any art or books, but maybe those were still packed away. In the bedrooms, it was clear they'd purchased entire suites of furniture off the showroom floor. All the pieces matched, light wood in Tommy's room, the style moderne. In Richard's bedroom, the headboard, chest of drawers, armoire, and two bed tables were heavy and dark, the design faintly Spanish with wrought iron pulls. Everything was spotlessly clean, which probably meant a crew of three coming in once a week. We made the complete circuit and ended up back in the kitchen. Both of us were conscious of the passage of time. Despite his earlier nonchalance, he seemed as aware as I was that Richard might roll in at any moment. He wasn't due for hours, but I could feel his presence, like a ghost in every room. Tommy had made no further comment about his brother's chilly attitude, and I didn't want to ask. For all I knew, the tension between them had nothing to do with me. Finally, in a show of bravado, Tommy said, "Would you like a drink?" "I think not, but thanks. I have work to do. I appreciate the tour. This is really great." "It needs work yet, but we like it. You'll have to see it by day. The landscaping's beautiful." He checked his watch. "I better get you home." I picked up my shoulder bag and followed him, waiting in the car while he locked the house again. In the confines of the Porsche, I was conscious of the charge in the air between us. We chatted on the drive, but it was make work in the face of my attraction to him. He found a parking space near Rosie's, half a block from my place. He parallel parked and then came around the car again to let me out. He offered me his hand in support, and I extracted myself with as much grace as I could manage. Sports cars should come equipped with quick ejection seats. The crowd noise from Rosie's was muffled, but I was aware of the contrast between the raucous din in there and the quiet where we were. Residual rain dripped from the nearby trees, and water gurgled along the gutters like an urban brook. We stood there for a moment, neither of us sure how to say good night. He reached over idly and adjusted the metal clasp on the front of my slicker. Don't want you wet. Can I walk you home? I'm just down there. You can almost see the place from here. He smiled. I know. I got the address from your application and checked it out earlier. Looks nice. You're nosy. Where you're concerned, he said. He smiled again and I found myself glancing away. We both said, well, at the same time and laughed. I walked backward a few steps, watching while he opened the door and folded himself under the steering wheel. He slammed the car door, and moments later the engine rumbled to life. The headlights flicked on, and he took off with a roar. I turned, proceeding to the corner, while the sound of his car faded at the end of the block. I confess my underwear felt warm and ever so faintly damp. Chapter 12. Tuesday morning dawned in a haze of damp and fog. I went through my usual morning routine, including a jog so vigorous it left me rosy-cheeked and sweating. After breakfast, I spent some time working at home, finishing revisions on my report for Fiona. Maybe all these neatly typed pages would pass for progress in her eyes. This was one of the few times in my life when I could see that I might fail, and I was scared. I anticipated her return with the same enthusiasm I'd felt any time I had to have a shot as a kid. I left my apartment at 9:35. With the temporary break in the storm, large bands of blue sky had appeared between the clouds. The grass had turned emerald green, and the leaves on all the trees were looking glossy and fresh. My appointment with Dow Purcell's best friend, Jacob Trigg, was scheduled for 10 o'clock. I'd studied a city map pinpointing a street address in the heart of Horton Ravine. I drove east along Cabana Boulevard and ascended the hill as it swept up from the beach. I turned left on Promontory Drive and followed the road along the bluffs that paralleled the beach. I turned left again and drove through the back entrance to Horton Ravine. Tommy crossed my mind, and I smiled in a goofy glow I found embarrassing. A mile down the road, I saw the street I was looking for. I turned right through a warren of winding lanes and drove up the hill. Water rushed in a torrent along the berm, and what looked like entire gravel driveways had washed out into the road. A tree with shallow roots had toppled backward, pulling up a half moon of soil. Despite the numerous houses in the area, Mother Nature was busy reclaiming her own. I peered to my right, checking mailboxes as I crept along. I finally spotted the house number Jacob Trigg had given me. Enormous black wrought-iron gates stood open, and I drove up a long curving lane between low stone walls. At the top of the slow rise, the parcel became flat, and I could see gently undulating acreage sweeping out in all directions. The two-story house was Italianate in feel, elegant and plain, with a symmetrical window placement and a small porch in front with a circular balustrade. I parked and got out. All the ground-floor windows were disconcertingly dark. There was no doorbell, and no one answered my repeated knocks. I circled the house, checking for lights or other signs of the inhabitants. The air was still, except for the occasional water dripping from the eaves. Had Trigg stood me up? I took a moment to check my bearings. Formal gardens stretched out on either side of the house, but there was not a gardener in sight. Probably too wet to do much work. I started down the sloping lawn, hoping to come across someone who'd tell me if Trigg was home. For the next 5 minutes, I wandered across the property, grass squishing underfoot where underground springs had suddenly resurfaced. At the end of a row of ornamental pears, I spotted a greenhouse with a small potting shed attached. An electric golf cart was parked nearby. I picked my way forward, mindful of the mud sucking at the soles of my boots. I could see a man working at a high bench just inside the shed. Despite the cold, he wore khaki shorts and muddy running shoes. There were braces on both legs, secured by what looked like screws driven in on either side of his knees. I could see signs of atrophy in the muscles of his calves. Propped up against the counter beside him was a pair of forearm crutches. The billed cap he wore covered a thatch of gray hair. On the redwood surface in front of him, there were five or six ratty-looking potted plants in various stages of decline. I paused in the doorway, waiting for acknowledgement before I went in. Beyond the far doorway, the greenhouse opened up, but the angled glass ceiling wasn't visible from where I stood. Most of the side panes were an opaque white, but in places the glass was clear, admitting bright squares of light. The air was warm and smelled of loam and peat moss. "Hi, sorry to interrupt, but are you Mr. Trigg?" He scarcely looked up.
"That's me. What can I do for you?"
"I'm Kinsey Milhone." He turned and looked at me blankly, a knot forming between his eyes. His mustache was iron gray, and his brows were an untidy mix of black and gray hairs. I guessed he was in his early 60s, red-nosed, jowly, and heavy through his chest, which sloped forward and down into a sizable belly. "I was hoping you could answer some questions about Dr. Purcell," I prompted. His confusion seemed to clear.
"Oh, sorry. I forgot you were coming, or I'd have waited at the house."
"I should have called to remind you. I appreciate your taking the time to talk to me."
"Hope I can be of help," he said. "Folks call me Trigg, so you can skip all the Mr. stuff. Doesn't seem to fit."
He leaned against the crude redwood counter and stirred a quick squirt of detergent into one of two buckets of water sitting side by side. He reached for a twig of miniature rosebush festooned with cobwebs. He placed his hand on the soil at the base of the plant, turned it upside down, and dunked it in the water.
"I'm surprised you found me. My daughter lives with me, but she's out this morning."
"Well, I did wander quite a bit. I'm glad you don't have a roving pack of attack-trained dogs."
"That bunch is put away for the moment," he said without pause.
I really hope this was a sample of his dry wit. Hard to tell, as his tone of voice and his facial expression didn't change.
"In case you're wondering what I'm up to, I'm not a horticulturist by trade. My daughter has a business taking care of houseplants for folks here in Horton Ravine. She does a bit of hotel work, too. The Edgewater, Montebello Inn, places like that. All live plants, no fresh flowers. I guess they hire someone else to do the big fancy arrangements. She brings me the sickly kids, and I nurse them back to health."
He righted the dripping rosebush and then swished it in the bucket of clear water. He pulled it out, shook it off, and studied the effect.
"This little guy's suffering from an infestation of spider mites. Suckers are only a 50th of an inch long, and look at the damage. Used to have healthy foliage, now it's no more than a twig. I'll keep it in quarantine. We see a lot of root rot, too. People over water, trying to be helpful between Susan's visits. You a plant person?"
"Not much. Used to have an air fern, but I finally threw it out."
"Smell like feet," he said, with a shake of his head.
He set the rosebush aside and reached for a corn plant in a terracotta pot. I watched while he sponged a dark gray powdery coating from the leaves.
"Sooty mold," he said, as though I'd inquired. "Plain old soapy water is good for a lot of these things. I'm not opposed to a systemic poison, but something like aphids, I prefer to try a contact pesticide first. Malathion or nicotine sulfate, which is basically your Black Flag 40. I'm conservative, I guess. Susan sometimes disagrees, but she can't argue with my success."
I said, "I take it you're an old friend of Dr. Purcell."
"A good 20 years. I was a patient of his. He testified in my behalf in the lawsuit following my auto accident."
"This was before he got into geriatrics?"
"I certainly hope so," he said.
I smiled. "What kind of work did you do?"
"I was a detail man. Drug sales. I covered the Tri-Counties, calling on doctors in private practice. I met Dow when he still had his office over near St. Terry's."
"You must have done well. This property's impressive."
"So was the settlement. Not that it's any compensation. I used to jog and play tennis. Take your body for granted until it goes out on you. Hell of a thing, but I'm luckier than some."
He paused, peering over at me.
"I take it you talked to Crystal. She called to say you'd probably be getting in touch. How's it going so far?"
"It's frustrating. I've met with a lot of people, but all I've picked up are theories when what I need are facts." His tangled eyebrows met in the middle, forming a crimp. I suspect I'm only going to add to the general confusion. I've been thinking about him, going back over things in my mind. Police talked to me the first week he was gone, and I was as baffled as anyone.
How often did you see him?
Once or twice a week. He'd stop by for coffee in the mornings on his way to Pacific Meadows. I know you gals think men don't talk about personal matters, more like sports, cars, and politics is your sense of it. Dow and I, we were different. Maybe because he'd seen me go through so much pain and suffering, without complaint, I might add. He was a man tended to keep his own counsel, and I think he valued that in others. He was only 8 years my senior, but I looked on him as a father. I felt comfortable telling him just about anything. We built us a lot of trust, and in time he confided in me as well. People admire him, as well they should. He's a good man, or was. I'm not at all sure how we should speak of him. Present tense, I hope, but that remains to be seen. Crystal tells me Fiona hired you.
That's right. She's in San Francisco on business, but she's coming back this afternoon. I'm scrambling around, talking to as many people as I can, hoping to persuade her the money's well spent.
I wouldn't be concerned. Fiona's hard to please, he said. Who's on your list aside from me?
Well, I've talked to one of his two business associates.
Which one?
Joel Glazer. I haven't talked to Harvey Brodus. I talked to people at the clinic and his daughter Blanche, but not Melanie. His eyebrows went up at the mention of her name, but he made no comment.
What about Lloyd Musco, Crystal's ex-husband? Have you spoken to him?
I hadn't thought to, but I could. I saw him at Crystal's on Friday afternoon when he came to get Leela. How does he fit in?
He might or might not. About 4 months back, Dow mentioned that he went to see Lloyd. I assumed it had something to do with Leela, but maybe not. You know, Leela lived with Lloyd briefly. She'd been busy telling everyone she was old enough to decide. Crystal got tired of fighting her, so Leela went to Lloyd's. She started 8th grade in the public schools up here. Wasn't here 2 months, and she was out of control. Grades fell, she was truant, into alcohol and drugs. Dow put his foot down, and that's when they stepped in and enrolled her in Fitch. Now she's strictly regulated, and she blames Dow for that. Sees him as a tyrant being anyone who won't let her have her way. I think she's mad at Lloyd, too. When I was over there, she was refusing to see him, but Crystal insisted. I don't doubt she's mad at him. She thinks it's his job to get her out of there. Doesn't want to look at her own behavior. Her age, you always think it's someone else's fault.
What happened when Dow went to see Lloyd? Did they quarrel?
Not that I know. But if Lloyd intended to do Dow harm, he'd be way too wily to tip his hand with any public display.
I reached in my bag and found a stray envelope so I could make a note. Can you give me his address?
I don't remember offhand. I can tell you where it is, though. Big house, yellow shingles, pitch roof. Right there at the corner of Missile and Olivio. Lloyd rents the little studio in back.
I think I know the place, I said. I gather he and Crystal get along okay.
More or less. She still tends to lick his boots. Crystal was always under Lloyd's thumb.
How so?
He lived off her earnings when she worked as a stripper in Las Vegas. They had one of those hot-headed relationships full of drinking and fights. One or the other would end up calling the police, screaming bloody murder. Crystal would have Lloyd arrested, and then, next thing you know, she'd change her mind and refuse to press charges. He'd accuse her of assault and battery, then they'd kiss and make up. Oldest story in the book. After she met Dow, she dropped everything and moved to Santa Teresa with the girl. I guess she saw Dow as her ticket out, which, in a way, he was. Problem was, Lloyd followed her, and he was furious. Couldn't believe she'd leave him after all they'd been through. Couldn't believe he'd lost control, is more like it.
How do you know all this?
I heard it from Dow, he said. I think he was worried Lloyd would find a way to reassert his dominance. Crystal looks strong, but where Lloyd's concerned, she's motivated by guilt. He claims she owes him big time for turning his life upside down.
Doesn't he work?
Not so's you'd notice. He did construction for a while, but then he claimed he'd injured his back. He'll live on workers' comp until the money runs out. That's how his mind works. Why put out the effort if he can get what he wants by manipulating someone else?
But surely Crystal's out from under him.
A woman like her is never out from under a man.
I tucked the envelope away, trying to think what other ground I might cover. What about the book Dow was writing? That's one reason Crystal's convinced something's happened to him. She says he wouldn't just walk out, first of all because of Griffith, and secondly because of the book he was working on.
A pained expression seemed to cross Trigg's face. Started out, he was excited about the project, but the task turned out to be a lot harder than he thought. I'd say he was more discouraged than enthusiastic. He was also upset about Fiona. She kept pressing him for money. He knew she was convinced he was going back to her, and that distressed him no end. That's why he was on his way up there.
What do you mean, up there?
He was going to see Fiona to clarify the situation.
The night he disappeared?
That's what he told me. We had breakfast together that Friday morning, and he said she'd insisted on a meeting. She was always insisting on something. Oh, she's a pain in the ass, if you'll forgive me, my being blunt. I told Dow then what I'd been saying all along. She was always going to demand a pound of flesh from him. She couldn't stop him leaving her, but she could surely make him pay.
What in the world made her think he'd leave Crystal and go back to her?
Oh, she had it all worked out, according to him. Said she was the only one understood him, for better or worse. I guess she was big on worse.
Fiona tells me Dow disappeared on two previous occasions. Any idea where?
Rehab. He told me he went to a dry-out farm.
Alcohol?
That's right. He didn't want it known, felt his patients would lose confidence if they knew his drinking was out of control.
I've heard from a couple of different sources he was drinking again.
Probably Fiona's influence. She'd drive any man to drink.
Couldn't he have checked into another rehab facility?
I hope so. I surely do. But then again, you'd think he'd have let someone know by now.
Fiona says he didn't say a word to anyone before.
That's not quite true. He told me.
What do you know about the business at Pacific Meadows?
Trigg shook his head. Not much. I know it wasn't looking good. I told him to hire an attorney, but he said he didn't want to do that yet. He had his suspicions about what was going on, but he wanted to check it out himself before he did anything else.
Someone told me he was worried Crystal would jump ship if the uproar became public.
Trigg tossed his sponge in a bucket. Maybe that's what Fiona was counting on, he said.
I walked into the office at 11:25 to find Jennifer bending over a file drawer in a skirt so short the two crescent-shaped bulges of her hiney were hanging out the back. Her legs were long and bare, tanned from all the days she took off to go to the beach with her pals. I said, "Jennifer, you're really going to have to wear longer skirts. Don't you remember, I see London, I see France, I see someone's underpants?"
She jerked upright and tugged self-consciously at the hem of her skirt. At least she had the good grace to look embarrassed. She clopped back to her desk in her wooden-soled clogs. She sat down, exposing so much bare thigh I felt compelled to avert my eyes.
"Any messages?" I asked.
"Just one. Mrs. Purcell says she's back and she's expecting you at 2 o'clock.
"When? Today or tomorrow?"
"Oh...
don't worry about it. I can figure it out. Anything else?"
"This came,"
she said, and handed me an express mail envelope. I opened the flap. Inside was the contract Fiona had signed and returned. Shit. I already hated feeling bound to her.
"Also, someone's here to see you. I showed her into your office and took her a cup of coffee."
That got my attention. "You left her in my office by herself?"
"I have work to do. I couldn't stay."
"How do you know she's not back there going through my desk?" I said, knowing that's what I'd be doing if I were in her place.
"I don't think she'd do that. She seems nice.
I could feel my heat gauge rising into the red zone. I seem nice, too. That doesn't count for much. How long's she been there? To be fair, I was probably displacing my feelings about Fiona onto her, but I was pissed anyway. Jennifer made a face to show she was thinking real hard.
Not long. 20 minutes? Maybe a little more.
Is she at least someone I know?
I think so, she said faintly. Her name's Mariah something. I just figured she'd be more comfortable back there than if she waited for you out here.
Jennifer, in that length of time, she could have ripped me off for everything I own.
You said that. I'm sorry.
Oh, forget about sorry. Don't ever do it again. I headed down the inner corridor. I looked back at her. And get some pantyhose, I snapped. As I passed Ida Ruth's desk, she was studiously avoiding my gaze, no doubt thrilled I was being subjected to a sample of Jennifer's continuing ineptitude. My office door was closed. I barged in to find a woman sitting in the guest chair. She placed her empty coffee mug on the edge of the desk in front of her. Scanning the surface, I could have sworn my files were ever so slightly disarranged. I looked at her quizzically, and she returned my gaze with eyes as blank and blue as a Siamese cat's. She couldn't have been more than 26, but her hair was a startling silver gray, as polished as pewter. She wore very little makeup, but her skin tones looked warm against the frosty hair, which was combed back and anchored behind her ears. She had a finely sculpted jaw, a strong nose and chin, lightly feathered brows. The skirt of her gray wool business suit was cut short, and sheer black hose emphasized her shapely knees, one of which carried the vestiges of an old scar. There was a black briefcase resting near the left side of her chair. She looked like an expensive lawyer with a high-powered firm. Maybe I was being sued. Warily, I moved back around my desk and sat down. She shed her jacket with ease and arranged it across the back of the chair to avoid wrinkling it. From the shape of her shoulders and upper arms, I knew she worked out a lot harder than I did.
"I'm Mariah Talbot," she said.
The black silk tank top rustled faintly as she reached across the desk to shake hands. She had long, oval nails painted a neutral shade. The effect was sophisticated. Nothing gaudy about this one. The most riveting feature was a gnarly white scar, probably a burn, on the outer aspect of her right forearm. "Do we have an appointment?" I asked, unable to keep the testiness out of my voice.
"We don't, but I'm here on a matter I think will interest you," she said, unruffled.
Whatever my disposition, it wasn't going to bother her. The image she projected was one of composure, competence, efficiency, and determination. Her smile, when it appeared, scarcely softened her face. "What's the deal?" She leaned forward, placing her business card on the desk in front of me. The face of it read, "Mariah Talbot, Special Investigations Unit, Guardian Casualty Insurance," with an address and phone number I scarcely stopped to read. The logo was a four-leaf clover with Home, Auto, Life, and Health written in each of the four loops.
"We need to have a chat about your landlord."
"Henry?"
"Richard Hevner."
I don't know what I expected, but it wasn't that. What about him?
"You may not be aware of this, but Richard and Tommy are fraternal twins."
"Really?" I said, thinking, who gives a shit?
"Here's something else you may not be aware of. Richard and Tommy murdered their parents back in Texas in 1983.
I could feel my lips parting slightly, as though in preparation for the punchline to a joke. The combination of the blue eyes and the silver hair was arresting, and I could hardly keep from staring. She went on, her manner completely matter-of-fact.
"They hired someone to break into the house. As nearly as we can tell, the plan was for the burglar to drill the safe and walk off with a substantial amount of cash, plus jewelry valued at close to $1 million. The boy's mother, Brenda, was the older of two girls who came from an incredibly wealthy Texas family named Atchison. Brenda inherited a stunning jewelry collection that she left, by will, to her only sister, Karen. These are pieces that have been passed down through the family for years."
She reached into her briefcase and pulled out a fat brown accordion file. She removed a manila folder and passed it over to me. These are the newspaper clippings, plus one copy each of the two wills. I opened the file and glanced at the first few clippings, dated January 15, 22, and 29 of 1983. In all three articles, Richard and Tommy were pictured, looking solemn and withdrawn, flanked by their attorney in a three-piece business suit. Headlines indicated the two were being questioned in the ongoing investigation of the homicides of Jared and Brenda Hevner. Additional articles covered the investigation over the balance of the year. I didn't stop to read the wills. Mariah Talbot went on.
You'll notice their Aunt Karen's name cropping up in some of the articles. The burglar was a punk named Casey Stonehart, who'd already been jailed 6 times for a variety of crimes, ranging from petty theft to arson, a minor specialty of his. We believe he opened the safe using the combination they'd given him. Then he dismantled the smoke detectors and set a blaze meant to cover up the crime. Apparently, and this is only a guess, the deal was he'd take the bulk of the jewelry, which he was in a position to fence. The boys would take the cash and maybe a few choice pieces, then submit a claim to the insurance company for the house, its contents, the jewelry, and anything else they could get away with. Oh, yes, the cars. 2 Mercedes-Benz were destroyed in the blaze. Mr. and Mrs. Hevner were found bound and gagged in the master bedroom closet. They died of smoke inhalation, which is not as bad as being burned alive, lucky them. Neither boy was anywhere in the area. In fact, both, by some miracle, were out of town and had ironclad alibis, she said. Stonehart, the kid who did the dirty work, disappeared soon afterward, probably dead and buried somewhere, though we have no proof. He's been missing ever since, so it's a safe bet they got rid of him. An accomplice is always the weak link in these things.
Couldn't he be in hiding?
If he were, he'd have been in touch with his family. They're all deadbeats and bums, but loyal to a fault. They wouldn't care what he'd done.
How do you know their loyalty doesn't include keeping mum about where he is?
The sheriff's department put a mail check in place, and there's a trace on the phone. Believe me, the silence has been absolute. This is a kid with big dependency issues. If he were alive, he couldn't tolerate the separation.
I cleared my throat. When was this again? I knew she told me, but I could hardly take it in.
1983, Hatchett, Texas. It didn't take long for suspicion to fall on the two boys, but they'd been extremely clever. There was little to suggest the part they'd played, beyond the obvious, of course. Financially, they cleaned up. For them, it must have been better than the lottery. To all appearances, there was no bad blood between them and their parents. No public disagreements, no recent increases in insurance coverage. There was also very little linking them to Casey Stonehart. No phone records showing calls between the brothers and him. Bank accounts showed no unusual withdrawals to suggest a down payment on Casey's services. The kid was such a lowlife he didn't even have a bank account. He kept his money in his mattress. The Sealy Posturepedic Savings and Loan. The three of them did attend the same high school. Casey was a year behind the Hevners, but there was no overt connection. It's not like they bowled in the same league or hung out together. Anything I'd felt for Tommy had evaporated. What about the parents' wills? Anything of interest there? Mariah shook her head. No changes in the terms since the document was drawn up when the boys were born. The attorney was a bit lax in that regard. The twins had reached their majority, and adjustments should have been made. Their Aunt Karen was still listed as their guardian if something happened to the parents.
What made the cops fix on them?
For one thing, neither of them can act. They put on a good show, but the feelings were all phony, strictly crocodile tears. At the time, both were still living at home. Tommy was one of those perpetual college students, his way of refusing to grow up and go out on his own. Richard fancied himself an entrepreneur, which meant he borrowed and squandered money as fast as it came into his hands. Jared was thoroughly disgusted with him. He considered them moochers, and he was sick of it. Brenda, too. This we heard about later from close friends of theirs. I'm assuming the brothers were charged. Mariah shook her head. Police investigators couldn't cobble together sufficient evidence to satisfy the DA. Of course, the insurance company balked at paying, but the boys filed suit and forced them to perform. Since they'd hadn't been arrested, charged with, or convicted of any crime, Guardian Casualty had no choice but to pay up. How much? $250,000 each in life insurance. The homeowners and auto claims came to a little over $750,000. This is Texas, don't forget. Not like real estate values you're used to dealing with out here. Also, despite his business acumen, Jared never managed to amass much in the way of wealth. A lot of what he did was probably under the table, which is neither here nor there. Anyway, along with the insurance, you add the cash in the safe, which probably amounted to another $100,000, and the jewelry on top of that, and you can see they did well. Guardian Casualty and Karen Atchison, the boy's aunt, are preparing to file a civil suit to recover their losses. We're convinced the boys still have the jewelry if we can find a way to prevail. I've been assigned to handle the preliminary investigation. Why now, when the murders were 3 years ago? I know proof in a civil case is easier, but you still have to have all your ducks in a row. Someone's come forward. An informant. Very hush-hush. This is the arsonist, a professional, who talked to Casey twice, once before the fire and then again right afterward. It was his expertise Casey was relying on, because the job was much bigger than anything he'd done in his piddling career. What was the arsonist getting in return? A piece of Casey's action. Once the arsonist found out about the killings, he wasn't willing to fess up to any part in it. He was nervous about a felony murder charge, or worse, that the brothers would kill him. Now he's decided to do what's right, and that's why we think we have a shot at this. Why doesn't he go to the cops and let them handle it? He will, if Garden Casualty comes up with the evidence. I push the file aside. And you're here to do what? Mariah smiled to herself as though privately amused. I've been nosing around. It looks like funds are low and the boys are getting on each other's nerves. We're counting on the fact they're having cash flow problems. That's why Richard agreed to lease the place to you, if you haven't figured that out. You offered him 6 months' rent in advance, and he needed the bucks. How'd you find out about that? We gimmicked up another applicant, a writer looking for an office away from his home. The cash is the explanation Richard gave when he turned him down. At any rate, the friction between the brothers could really work for us. I'm always hoping one will break down and rat the other one out. We've been after them for 3 years, and this is as close as we've come. What's this got to do with me? We'd like to hire you to do some work for us. Such as? We want you to pass along the name of a fence in Los Angeles. He's a jeweler by trade. The business looks legitimate on the surface, but he's actually a fence. He deals in stolen property when the quality or quantity is sufficient to make it worth the risk. With money getting scarce, the boys might be tempted to dip into the stash, which we don't think they've touched. But they can't get anywhere close to true value through a fence. What choice do they have? Wouldn't they be better off trying to auction some of the pieces through Christie's or Sotheby's? Christie's or Sotheby's would insist on a provenance. Proof the jewelry was theirs, which they can't provide. They may try selling to a private party, which is yet another reason we're stepping up the pace. So I pass along the information about the jeweler, and then what? We wait to see if they take the bait, and then we nail them. The Houston DA's already talked to the DA's office here, and they're ready to roll. Once we know the jewelry's in the house, we'll ask for a warrant and go in. Based on what? We'll have the fence, and the fence will have at least a portion of the jewelry. The boys are going to have a hell of a time explaining that. What if they don't make contact with him? We have another scheme in mind that I'd rather not go into. In the meantime, you might want to see the jewelry. Again, she reached into her briefcase, this time removing a manila folder with what looked like appraisals and a series of Polaroids. She sorted through the stack, laying picture after picture on the rim of my desk, rattling off the contents. Diamond Riviere necklace, valued at $120,000. An Art Deco diamond and sapphire bracelet, that one's $24,000. Diamond ring with the stone weighing in at 7.63 carats, worth $64,000. And check this one, A necklace with 86 graduated diamonds. That's somewhere between $43,000 and $51,000. Sorry about the pics. These are preliminary Polaroids. All the good appraisal photos are being circulated through Southern California.
She finished dealing out the pictures, reciting prices like a pitchman for a company selling door to door.
What makes you so sure they still have them?
An educated guess, she said. We know they bought a safe from a local locksmith. We figured they installed it at the house so each of them could keep an eye on the other. The problem is, we have no legitimate means of getting in.
Funny you should say that. I was there last night.
How'd you manage that?
Richard was gone. Tommy took me over and showed me around.
I don't suppose you spotted the safe?
I'm afraid not. There's barely any furniture and no wall art. I can tell you this, the entire alarm system's down. Tommy told me Richard set it off so many times they finally discontinued service. Now it's strictly window dressing.
Interesting. I'll have to think about that. When will you see him again?
I'm not going to see him again, after what you've told me.
Too bad. We could really use your help. He's taken an interest in a woman more than once, and Richard always puts a stop to it. He doesn't trust his little brother's tendency to blab. I don't think Richard realizes what a threat you are.
I'm a threat?
Of course. Tommy's hustling you, and that gives you power. Not a lot, but enough. You have access, for one thing. I'm not going to go sneaking around in there. I'd have no reason whatever to tour the house again. Besides, even if I found the safe, I wouldn't have the faintest idea how to open it.
We wouldn't want you to do that. All we need is the location, which couldn't be that hard. Once we have the warrant, we don't want the boys disposing of the evidence.
I thought about it briefly.
I won't do anything illegal.
Mariah smiled.
Oh, come now. From what we've heard, you're willing to cut corners when it suits you.
I stared at her.
You ran a background on me?
We had to know who we were dealing with. All we're asking you to do is pass along the information about the fence.
I don't like it. It's too risky.
Without risk, where's the fun? Isn't that the point?
Maybe for you.
I told you we intend to pay you for your time.
It's not about money. I don't want to be pimped.
Meaning what?
I won't peddle my ass so you can nail these guys. I'm a big fan of justice, but I'm not going to offer up my body to get the goods on them.
We're not asking you to go to bed with him. What you do in private is strictly your concern.
She closed her mouth, a move I've often employed myself, giving the other person the opportunity to work it out. I picked up a pencil and tapped it on the desk, letting my fingers slide the length as I flipped it end over end.
I'll think about it some and let you know.
Don't take too long.
She placed a slip of paper on the desk with a name and address written across the face of it.
This is the name of the jeweler. I'll leave it up to you how you play out the information. You can bill us for your time and gas mileage. If you decide you can't help, then so be it. Either way, we'll trust you to keep your mouth shut.
I took the paper and looked at the name.
You have a number where I can reach you?
I've been moving around. In an emergency, you can use the number on my card, but I think it'd be better if I called you. I'll touch base in a day or so and see how things stand. Meanwhile, I don't want the boys to know I'm here. I've been dogging them for years, and with this gray hair, I'm not exactly inconspicuous. If they find out we've spoken, you're in the soup. So, take care.
Chapter 13. By 1:45, having confirmed my appointment with Fiona, I found myself driving once more along Old Reservoir Road. The sky was a steel gray. The earlier patches of blue covered over with thick clouds again. I flicked a look to my right, taking in the sight of Brunswick Lake. Gusts of wind skipped like stones along the surface of the water, and trees at the shoreline tossed their shaggy heads. I parked, as I had before, on the side of the two-lane road. I reached for my shoulder bag and the brown manila envelope containing my report. I looked up at the house, which was dug into the hillside as though meant to withstand attack. 4 days had passed. but with a surfeit of rain, fresh weeds were sprouting across the property. I wasn't looking forward to the meeting, but it was better than having to think about Richard and Tommy Hevener. That problem was stuck in my throat like a bone. My first impulse was to bail on the new office space, thus severing all ties, but, cheap as I am, I hated to say bye-bye to more than $1,600. The conflict was thorny. Morality aside, it can't be socially correct to consort with a couple of stone-cold killers. But how could I get out of my deal with them? Even in California, the etiquette was baffling. Was one polite? Did one confess the reasons for refusing to do business? I thought about the soft light in Tommy's eyes, then pictured him patiently tying up his mother's hands before the house was set on fire. If he called me again, should I mention his parents' murders, or simply make some excuse? I wanted to act swiftly. Then again, by breaking off all contact, I was, in effect, refusing to help Mariah Talbot. I seldom shy away from risk, and, as she had so rudely observed, I was willing to cut corners when it suited me. As I locked my car door, I saw Trudy, the German shepherd I'd encountered on my last visit. She came racing up the road, a spirited pup, probably less than a year old, and thrilled to be out in the chill November air. The dog squatted to take a whiz, then placed her nose to the ground, tracing the erratic trail of a critter that had passed that way earlier, rabbit or possum, possibly a waddling raccoon. The dog's owner, coming up behind, was keeping an eye on her progress, in case she stumbled across something much bigger than she. By the time I'd clambered up the stairs to Fiona's front entrance, the woman and the dog were already out of sight. Henry and Rosie were always after me to get a mutt of my own, but I couldn't see the point. Why take responsibility for a creature who can't even use a flush toilet? Fiona must have been waiting, because I'd barely touched the bell before she opened the door. Her latest outfit consisted of a long-sleeved crepe blouse modeled on a post-war Eisenhower jacket, belted at the waist. Her black wool skirt was tubular and ended mid-shin, thus exposing the least attractive portion of any woman's leg. Her high heels were chunky with multiple ankle straps. Perched on her dyed brown curls was a version of the U.S. Women's Army Corps cap done in sequined velvet. I could smell cigarettes and Shalimar, and I was suddenly reminded of my aunt's jar of mum cream deodorant, which she'd rub into her armpits with the tips of her fingers. "You could have parked out back in the driveway instead of climbing all those stairs," Fiona remarked. The content was harmless, but her tone was resentful, as if she'd like nothing better than to pick a fight with me. "I need the exercise," I said, refusing to take the bait. As she stepped away from the door, she adjusted her watch, glancing down surreptitiously to see if I was late. As usual, I was bang on time, and I thought, ha-ha on you, as I followed her in. In the foyer, the painter's scaffolding was still in place, drop cloths blanketing the floor like a thin canvas snow. Nothing had been touched since our meeting on Friday, and I assumed she didn't trust the workmen to continue without her. Or maybe it was they who knew better than to go on laboring in her absence. She was the type who'd make them redo all the work as soon as she walked in the door. I could see that the wall still bore patches of three different shades of white. When I held out the brown manila envelope, you'd have thought I was offering her a bug on a tray. "What's this?" she asked suspiciously. "You said you wanted a report." She opened the envelope and peered at the pages. "Well, thank you. I appreciate that," she said, dismissing my labors with a glance. "I hope you won't object to talking in the bedroom. I'd like to unpack." "Fine with me." In truth, I was curious to see the rest of the place. The flight home was murder, one of those 30-seat orange crates blowing all over the place. I didn't mind the up and down so much as the side to side. I thought I'd never get home. Probably wind from the storm. I'll never fly on one of those small planes again. I'd rather go by rail, even if it takes half a day. She picked up a makeup case she'd stashed in the hall. She barely glanced at the larger suitcase. "Grab that for me." I picked up the hard-sided suitcase, feeling like a pack mule as I followed her up the stairs. That sucker was heavy. I watched her legs flashing in front of me as she mounted the steps. She wore stockings with seams, With her affinity for the 40s, I was surprised she didn't draw a line down the back of each bare leg the way women did during World War II rationing. We turned right at the landing and went into a white-on-white master suite, which featured a large wall of glass overlooking the road. I set her suitcase on the floor. While Fiona moved into the bathroom with her makeup case, I crossed to the windows to absorb the view. The coastline was completely enveloped in fog, thunderheads rising like ominous mountains in the distance. The hills were saturated with green plant life, responding to the rain with a sudden burst of new growth. In the overcast, Brunswick Lake had turned silver, its surface as flat and mottled as an antique mirror. I turned. Fiona's four-poster bed was situated so that she saw much of this, sun rising to her left, going down on her right. I tried to imagine what it would be like to sleep in a room this big. At one end of the room, double doors stood open to reveal a large walk-in closet the size of my loft. At the opposite end, there was a fireplace with easy chairs and a low glass coffee table arranged in front of it. I pictured Fiona and Dow having drinks up here on the nights when he stopped by. I wondered if they'd ever gone to bed together just for old time's sake. Fiona emerged from the bathroom and moved to the bed, where a second hard-sided suitcase was already laid open on the pristine spread. She began to remove the articles of clothing she'd packed with such care. "Why don't you start from the beginning and fill me in?" I opened my verbal recital with an improvisational medley of interviews, going back over my report in a series of beautifully articulated summations of events. I began with Detective Odessa, segued into my visit with Crystal Purcell, and then moved on to Pacific Meadows, at which point I delineated the nature of the difficulties Dow Purcell was facing. I wasn't even fully warmed up when I hit a sour note that undercut my confidence. Fiona had been moving back and forth from the bed to the walk-in closet, carrying blouses and skirts, which she hung on matching white satin padded hangers. She said, "You might as well follow me, otherwise I won't hear you and you'll have to repeat. My ears are still stopped up. Just one more reason for taking the train." I moved to the closet and stood in the doorway to continue the program. At any rate, Saturday afternoon I went up to Blanche's shortly after she phoned. Fiona turned to me. "You went over to see Blanche? Why in the world did you do that?" "She called me at home. I got the impression you'd already spoken to her." "I did no such thing, and I can't believe you'd take such a step without consulting me. No one's to be brought into this unless I say so. I'm paying for your time. If I'd wanted you to see Blanche, I'd have given you her number." "I thought you did. I gave you Melanie's, not hers. How much did you tell her?" "I really don't remember. Honestly, I'm sorry, but she acted as if she knew all about me. So I assumed she'd talk to you or to Melanie. She said the two of them were so relieved because they've been urging you to hire someone ever since their father disappeared." "That's immaterial. I'll pass on information to the girls if it seems relevant, but I think it's inappropriate coming from you. Is that clear?" "Of course," I said, stung. Having paid Richard Hevner the entire $1,500 Fiona had given me, I no longer had the means to refund her original retainer. Deducting $50 for the time I'd spent with Trigg, I now owed her $1,075 worth of services and realized, if I quit, there was no way to pay her back, short of pulling the money from my savings account. "Please go on," she murmured, resuming her chores. My temper emerged hard on the heels of injury, and I had to bite my tongue bloody to keep from telling her where to stick it. This resolution lasted until I opened my mouth. "You know what? Fun as this is, I'm already tired of taking crap from you. I've worked my butt off this weekend, and if my methods don't suit you, I'm out of here." For the second time within minutes, I'd managed to surprise and amaze. She seemed genuinely flustered, backing down as fast as she could manage it. "That's not what I meant. I apologize if I offended you. That wasn't my intent." There's nothing more effective than an apology for knocking me off my high horse. I backed down as fast as she had, and we spent the next few minutes smoothing one another's ruffled feathers before moving on. Then Fiona asked me about the game plan, like I had one. "How do you intend to go about finding him?" "Ah," I said. "Well, I have some other people I want to talk to first, and then we'll see where we stand. In truth, I was at a loss. Her eyes glittered briefly, and I thought she might challenge me, but she seemed to think better of it. "A couple of questions," I said. "Someone thought Dow might have gone into an alcohol rehab facility on the two occasions when he disappeared in the past. Any chance he might have left the country instead?" She hesitated. "What difference would that make?" "Lonnie Kingman questioned it. He's the attorney I rent space from. He suggested Dowan might have been moving currency into foreign bank accounts in preparation for flight." "It never occurred to me." "It didn't occur to me either, but the first time we met, you did seem to think he might be in Europe or South America." "Well, yes, but I can't believe he'd planned such a thing all those years in advance." "Did you ever look at his passport?" "Of course not. What reason would I have?" "Just an idea," I said. "Maybe that's why the passport's missing. He took it so no one could go back and see where he'd been on those earlier trips." "You mentioned two questions." I waited until she made eye contact with me. "Why didn't you tell me he was on his way over here that night?" Casually, she placed a hand against her throat. The gesture was self-protective, as though she were warding off a slash at her carotid artery. "He never arrived. I thought it was a miscommunication. I tried calling his office the next day, but he was already gone by then." "Why was he coming?" "I don't see why it matters, since he never showed." "Was anyone else in the house with you that night?" I asked. "To support my story?" "That'd be nice, don't you think?" "I'm afraid I can't help. This is a small town, tongues wag. I wouldn't even let him leave his car on the parking pad. I had him pulled into the empty garage. No one knew about his visits."
"At least no one you told."
I felt badly as soon as I said it, because the look in her eyes was one of betrayal. "He swore he wouldn't tell Crystal. He said it would only hurt her, and neither of us wanted that." "I didn't say he told Crystal. This was someone else."
"Trig,"
I said. "Yes." "After all, it was her money. She was entitled to the information. My scruples, though few, are somewhat spotty as well. What about Lloyd Musco? Did Dow ever talk to you about him?"
"A bit."
"They disliked each other and avoided contact whenever possible. At first it was territorial. They were like rival apes, which Crystal must have enjoyed. Later the friction between them was more about Leela's relationship with Lloyd."
"I heard that Dow considered Lloyd a bad influence on the girl."
"I don't really know Lloyd, so I'm reluctant to discuss the subject."
"Ah, give it a try. I'm sure you can manage something."
"He's common, for one thing."
"Happily, that isn't a crime in this state, or I'd be under arrest myself."
"You know perfectly well what I'm talking about. They're paying a great deal of money to send her to that private school. I don't see the point when she spends half her weekends with someone like him."
"But Lloyd's the only father she's known. Crystal must feel it's important for Leela to maintain a relationship with him,
if that's her motive.
Perhaps she prefers to have the time to herself.
Leela's behavior goes way beyond the norm for her age. It's obvious the girl is seriously disturbed. I'm sure Lloyd resented Dow's interference. Instead of taking time with Blanche, you should have been talking to him."
Trig had told me Lloyd lived in the little studio behind the big yellow shingle house at the corner of Missile and Olivio. I parked out in front and made my way down the narrow driveway on foot. Shaggy hedges encroached on either side, forming walls of wet foliage that showered drops as I passed. There was a 1952 Chevrolet parked on the grass at the end of the drive. The occasional wet leaf was plastered to the hood, but aside from that it seemed clean and well cared for. The backyard was overgrown, and the small wood-frame studio might have been a gardener's shed at one time. I went up two shallow wooden porch steps and rapped on the frame of the screen door. No one answered my knock. It took a few minutes to circle the studio, moving from window to window, peering in at the place. I could see four small rooms, living room, kitchen, two tiny bedrooms with a bath between, all empty. I went back to the front door and opened the screen. I tried the knob. The door swung open at my touch.